These objectives flowed from the NDS's first two lines of effort, building a more lethal and ready force, and strengthening allies and growing new partners. After some final opening comments that emphasized taking care of our people, living our values, and remaining apolitical, I turned to the hard work of the day, which was reviewing and fine-tuning each of the implementation objectives I had disseminated in advance. The final top 10 list that we agreed upon that day were as follows, accompanied by an associated timeline and lead agency or office responsible for their completion. Review, update, and approve all China and Russia plans. Implement the Immediate Response Force, Contingency Response Force, and Dynamic Force Employment Enhanced Readiness Concepts. Reallocate, reassign, and redeploy forces in accordance with the NDS. Achieve a higher level of sustainable readiness. Develop a coordinated plan to strengthen allies and build partners. Reform and manage the Fourth Estate, defined hereafter, and DOD. Focus the department on China. Modernize the force. Invest in game-changing technologies. Establish realistic joint war games, exercises, and training plans. And develop a modern joint warfighting concept and, ultimately, doctrine. Lastly, I spoke to the NDS's third line of effort, the one that I expected would be the toughest for everyone. Reform. My plan was to improve our business practices, become more efficient, and free up funding by digging deep into the Fourth Estate, the combatant commands, and the armed services, in that order. This got a lot of people's attention, especially the combatant commanders. I suspected some folks thought I wasn't really serious about this topic, but my former Army colleagues in the room knew better. My first major push when it came to reform was to take a night court approach to the so-called Fourth Estate, the collective name for DOD agencies and activities that are not part of the military branches, ranging from the OSD and the Joint Staff to the Defense Logistics Agency and Missile Defense Agency. There are more than 24 of these organizations, and they include more than 380,000 people and spend more than $100 billion, nearly 15% of the entire DOD budget, annually. I would learn that some of these agencies had become an avenue through which a combatant command could get funding for engagement activities with countries in its area of responsibility, a connection unknown to several of us. Any increase in defense agency budgets to support these backdoor initiatives often came at the expense of service plans and budgets, without an enterprise-wide evaluation of alignment with our established priorities, return on investment, or the opportunity costs associated with these activities. This needed close and immediate attention. I was going after $7 to $10 billion in reform of the Fourth Estate in the coming year, and we were making good progress. But this amount wasn't nearly enough to pay for our modernization plans and other initiatives. Moreover, I didn't have the time to continue doing reform meetings week after week, the pace I had largely been keeping since I became Secretary of Defense. What we needed at the OSD level was a completely different management system, and the type of leadership model that can spend every day and week driving efficiency, oversight, and effectiveness. As a result, we developed a novel management structure that put Chief Management Officer Lisa Hirschman in charge of the Fourth Estate. We gave her control over the budget and personnel of these agencies, while leaving the operational activities the responsibility of each group's undersecretary. For the first time, the Fourth Estate would now have to participate in the annual budget build and program objective memorandum process, just like the services. This would be the accountability and control we desperately needed. David Norquist and I were able to find $5.7 billion, a few billion short of what I wanted, after 4 months of work in the fall of 2019. We spent a good amount of time, a few hours each week we were in town, boring into these agencies. I told Hirschman that she had to find at least $5 billion more for the following year. Meanwhile, there would be no growth in the Fourth Estate and no bills imposed on the services. Hirschman was confident she could deliver on the additional savings, and the service secretaries were pleased to learn their budgets wouldn't be raided again. Congress eliminated the chief management officer position in 2020 after many years of dissatisfaction with the outcomes it failed to achieve. But we made the case to the defense committees that having a single person in charge of the Fourth Estate, if only for the administrative and budgetary purposes I enacted, showed promise. We were working on this when I left office that November. The second avenue for reform scrutinized the combatant commands. I'm not sure they had ever been analyzed in detail, if at all, but I was confident we could find savings. Unfortunately, some of the commands viewed cost-cutting and reform as things the Pentagon did to fund their operations. Not all of the four stars saw a role for themselves when it came to reform. Neither view was correct, of course. We all had an obligation to be good stewards of the taxpayers' dollars. We were making solid progress on the first ever DoD audit, a priority for me, but still had a couple of years to go. I told the combatant commanders that finding efficiencies and savings will be a big part of your reviews. Moreover, I saw these reform initiatives not only as a means to free up funds for modernization of the force, but also as one of my first acts to assert greater civilian control by imposing accountability and fiscal discipline on the combatant commands. What we found as we dug into the issue surprised us. Each command's plans, operations, structure, and budgets were driven by an accumulation of orders, policies, and other instructions over the years, coupled with their assigned missions, which were often self-written, and the specified and implied tasks derived from all of the above. These tasks numbered in the several hundred. Some topped 1,000. While scores of them were administrative, many were substantive tasks that were no longer necessary, no longer made sense, were out of date, or were too broad, but they drove resource demands nonetheless. The commands were dutifully implementing them with people, assets, and funding. All of this needed scouring in detail, and each command's mission statement needed to be reviewed, fine-tuned, and approved by the Secretary of Defense. General Milley and the Joint Chiefs took this on with appropriate involvement by my civilian policy shop. Finally, I called upon the armed services to dig deep to find savings. I privately sensed that the large annual increases under Trump were ending, which regrettably proved to be true. So we needed to get ahead of the curve on our budgets. Each of the services was at a different stage in doing this, with the Army out front and the Navy lagging. The Air Force's efforts were in between and complicated by the pending birth of Space Force in December 2019. All the armed forces had modernization plans, with some more aggressive and forward-looking than others. To pay for this, each of the services had plans to divest systems that were no longer needed or sufficient for the future fight. They were also looking for money from the OSD. I'm not prepared to give you more money or change the budget allocations between services, I often told them, until we have updated war plans for China and Russia, a new joint warfighting concept, and clear evidence that you've done the hard work of reform in your departments first. I didn't have free money to throw around, didn't want to reward bad behaviors, and certainly didn't want to invest in a particular area only to find out later that we were headed in a different direction. Instead, I focused on investing in the top 11 modernization initiatives that we had identified as the game changers for all the services. The NDS directed the department to modernize key capabilities in order to address the scope and pace of our competitors' and adversaries' ambitions and capabilities. The technology areas identified as critical to NDS implementation were microelectronics, autonomy, cyber, 5G communications, fully networked command, control, and communications, space, hypersonics, quantum science, biotechnology, artificial intelligence, AI, and directed energy. These technologies, such as artificial intelligence, hypersonics, quantum science, biotechnology, directed energy, microelectronics, and 5G networks, would ensure our continued overmatch, a military concept that values having overwhelming advantages, superiority, over an adversary to a more significant margin as critical for national security, in the future. Indeed, we put billions of additional dollars into these areas, making the fiscal year 2021 budget submission the largest research and development funding in the department's history. And the FY 2022 budget that we built the following year, in 2020, the same one the Biden administration delivered to Congress in 2021, was even bigger when it came to research and development. Additionally, we released modernization roadmaps for these technologies. For example, we accelerated the development of hypersonics, with plans to start fielding them in 2023 by ramping up flight testing, with over 40 flight tests planned in the next 5 years. And when it came to microelectronics and 5G, we improved our access to advanced commercial and specialty microelectronics, later working to reshore high-end chip production in the United States, and leveraging the power of 5G for our mission sets. As part of this effort, we initiated large-scale experiments to test and evaluate 5G communications capabilities at 12 DoD bases, working alongside industry partners. On AI, which many experts and I believe will change the character of warfare for generations to come, we sped up the fielding of AI capabilities at scale to meet warfighter needs through the Joint Artificial Intelligence Center. After all, my view was that AI would afford decisive and enduring advantages to whoever harnessed and mastered it first. And we had to be first. To do so, we established the first official Chief Data Officer under the Chief Information Officer, issued the first DoD data strategy to guide improvements on the availability and reliability of department information, and created the first ever AI ethics principles to ensure the United States is the global leader in the responsible development and use of AI. Finally, we took additional steps to support management operations by developing platforms for senior leaders to interact with live data. If there was one technology critical to winning the future against China and Russia, it was AI, and we had a lot of work to do. In early July 2020, less than a year after the Senior Leader Conference, I would deliver a 10-minute video update on our progress in meeting these objectives, and was pleased to report that we had achieved a good deal on most of them. With many in the department distracted by the social unrest that occurred just weeks prior and other things that were happening at the time, I felt it important to celebrate their efforts and progress, and to keep everyone focused on the critical work of continuing to implement the NDS. It was also important to let Congress, the think tank world, and the media know that the Pentagon understood what its mission and top priorities were, and that we continued to press forward. However, I knew in October 2019 that in order to get as far as we hoped by midsummer 2020, when I would give my NDS progress update, I needed empowered and engaged civilian leadership driving these efforts. I also stressed the importance of the group becoming a closely knit leadership team that worked far more closely together, far more often, to accomplish our shared goals. There was some rumbling in the building about the meeting changes and process adjustments I had already made, so I wanted to address the issue head on. "Civilians are in charge," I said. "And to do their jobs effectively, the secretaries, undersecretaries, and others need to be involved in the relevant processes that had either stagnated or excluded them. In addition, I told my secretaries that I need civilian leaders who are engaged and prepared to assert their proper roles. As the old saying goes, when in charge, take charge." They got the message. In September 2019, Defense One, an independent trade publication that covers the national security landscape, published an article entitled, "Two Cheers for Esper's Plan to Reassert Civilian Control of the Pentagon." All three authors had been advisors to other defense secretaries. They astutely made the point that civilian control is a process, not simply a person. They added, "Civilians are losing control over key processes that manage war plans, deployment decisions, and the programs that determine what kind of military the U.S. builds for the future." They weren't entirely correct about the last point, but they hit the mark on the first two items. Over the succeeding months, beginning in the fall of 2019, The civilian leadership in the OSD and the services would start reasserting control and involving themselves in the processes where appropriate and necessary. For example, our war plans needed updating. If war is an extension of politics, and the political objective must be kept in mind at all times during war, as that timeless maxim by the 19th century Prussian general and military theorist Karl von Clausewitz goes, then the civilian political leadership must ensure the plans and preparations being made by the military to achieve that political outcome are aligned and credible. This is why I felt so strongly about personally reviewing and updating the war plans, as well as about ensuring my civilian appointees were leading this process. That meant my policy team, led by John Rood, had to be intimately involved in the process. There was organizational resistance by some on the joint staff who viewed war planning as the military's exclusive domain. Rood was having some challenges breaking through. It ultimately took me having to review and approve a flowchart for war planning to make sure Rood and I felt comfortable about policy's role and insertion points in the process. We eventually succeeded, and everything was in much better shape after that, once the new system took root. In-progress reviews of the evolving Russia and China war plans would be a necessary and recurring agenda item at the Monday afternoon NDS sessions with the combatant commanders and the leadership team in the Pentagon. The policy team was now leading these reviews. Moreover, having the four-star combatant commanders in the room was important because we all agreed that conflict with a peer, near-peer rival would be global in nature, and not limited to either Asia or Europe. Conflict would also not be limited to geographic domains. Having Space Command, Strategic Command, Transportation Command, and Cyber Command also attend was essential. And of course, Northern Command was vital to protecting the homeland, especially U.S. airspace from enemy aircraft and missiles. Another major issue that demanded greater participation from civilian leaders was global force management and the deployment of the armed forces. The Secretary of Defense is the only person in the DoD with the authority to deploy military units. Deployment orders that captured the detailed information necessary to send forces around the globe are the instrument for doing this. Large binders containing these orders arrived at my office about every 2 weeks for my review and approval. These proposed deployments are studied by the affected services and combatant commands, and adjustments are often negotiated to get everyone to concur. It was not unusual to receive non-concurs if a command or a service believed that some aspect of a deployment would cause them serious hardship or present a very high risk. Some commands played the significant risk card, which inevitably attracted everyone's attention, too often. What troubled me early on was not the give and takes of this process, but that the only persons in the room to explain them to me was the uniformed joint staff. They would march into my office, sit down at the large conference table, and start walking me through the various orders. In the early days, I would ask, "Where's policy? What's their view?" Or, "Why isn't Joe Kernan, the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, here? What does he think?" I would be given a quick answer and a reminder that his office signed off on this. But that wasn't what I asked. I wanted to hear straight from the stakeholders, and I wanted the policy team, and others, in the room as well to verify policy alignment and offer their views. The same thing occurred with deployments that I knew impacted the services, all of them. I would often ask, "What do the Chief of Naval Operations and Navy Secretary say? How about the Army, McConville, and McCarthy?" What I found is that most of these orders were being agreed to at levels below them. Sometimes the uniformed chiefs were not in the loop, and usually the service secretaries were not apprised. This all had to change. I wanted to hear from the principals, especially the civilians, when there were disagreements, and I wanted a healthy debate and discussion. It wasn't good enough on matters of such importance to simply have some officer on the joint staff represent the service's views. Just like with our war planning processes, there was some initial resistance, but it didn't take long to make this change happen and get everyone comfortable with this new normal. We eventually added other OSD civilian leaders as well, depending on the issue. But it was another early effort to restore the proper balance in civilian-military relations at the Pentagon. Along these same lines, I would later approve a new Global Force Management Allocation Plan, GFMAP, which further aligned our force allocation to the National Defense Strategy. This also caused some stir. The GFMAP better balanced the interests of the services and the combatant commands and shifted forces to higher priority missions. We also increased the deployment-to-dwell ratio, the proportion of time a unit is deployed abroad versus the time spent at home, for many units, so that service members had more time at home to recover and train and more time with their families before going abroad again. Also importantly, we increased the size, scope, and readiness of our Immediate Response Forces, IRF, to make them more operationally available and flexible. We now had forces from all the services packed and ready to go to war within a few days' notice. The next evolution of this new preparedness posture was to begin no-notice call-outs, where we could verify and evaluate IRF units' readiness to deploy, fight, and win. Such readiness exercises would offer good training, too, while also making us more operationally unpredictable to the Chinese and Russians. Other areas where I saw my civilian undersecretaries take the initiative and play a very important role were the two top 10 objectives that required development of a coordinated plan to strengthen allies and build partners, and the department to establish realistic joint war games, exercises, and training plans. These initiatives were related to one another, as well as to our new operational concepts associated with the IRF. And not surprisingly, they also generated their own share of internal pushback. In my assessment, the combatant commander's training and exercise plans weren't always of the quality and caliber I expected. General Milley shared this view as well. Too often, it seemed, the commands sacrificed the quality training that really improved the readiness and integration of the joint force with our allies and partners at the altars of volume and fanfare. The DoD defines the term joint force as a force composed of elements assigned or attached of two or more military departments, for example, Army, Navy, operating under a single joint force commander. A geographic combatant command, such as European Command, for example, is a joint force, as it is assigned or attached forces from more than one department, similar to the DoD's other combatant commands. The metric for success had seemed to become counting the number of events year over year, regardless of their value, instead of assessing the unit's ability to fight and win together after the training. These events were also costly. To meet the demands of our strategy, we needed to return to a more centralized and traditional stance regarding the training, exercise, and evaluation of our forces when it came to readiness and deployability. By the spring of 2020, Undersecretary Matt Donovan, Milley, and I were meeting monthly to track and push this initiative, which wasn't moving as quickly as I liked. The joint staff was overwhelmed with several major projects, including COVID and the development of the joint warfighting concept, but Milley was trying to juggle this task as well. I also asked the chairman to establish a joint staff training and exercise validation team that could travel the globe, make assessments, and report back to us. This would help validate the IRF and dynamic force employment concepts we had developed and began implementing, and give us timely and accurate assessments on IRF readiness. Matt Donovan was the Undersecretary for Personnel and Readiness. He brought a great deal of civilian and military experience to the role. He served 31 years in the Air Force, worked on Capitol Hill, and then served as Undersecretary of the Air Force beginning in August 2017. His thoughtfulness and willingness to effect change, even though it seemed many of those working for him resisted it, always impressed me. Donovan was working these initiatives hard. Despite our efforts, he would later share with me his nearly daily struggle with the joint staff when it came to OSD policy, guidance, and oversight. Their views on the military role at the Pentagon were deeply rooted, he conveyed with some annoyance. Some of the geographic combatant commanders also resisted the changes I sought. In their minds, I suppose, Pentagon-directed major force exercises would reduce their ability to conduct dozens of their annual exercises. I continued to emphasize with them that I value quality over quantity, and re-emphasized the importance I placed on warfighting. I had done my share of these engagement exercises with allies, as I called them, during my service in Europe. They had little training value, but were great for photo ops and diplomatic talking points. However, these engagements were also costly and time-consuming. In my view, they needed to be consolidated and/or reduced if we were to fund the return to training exercises of the size, scale, and quality necessary to validate and practice our joint war plans. It took a while, but we were finally making some progress by the time I left. The one top 10 task that probably stoked the most pushback from the combatant commanders, however, was the policy team's efforts to develop a single, coordinated plan to strengthen allies and build partners. James Anderson, who succeeded John Rood as the acting Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the spring of 2020, worked for months to develop what became the Guidance for the Development of Alliances and Partnerships, GDAP, a strategy that was the first of its kind. Anderson arrived at the Pentagon in 2018 with a solid professional background. He began his career as a Marine Corps intelligence officer and later served in OSD policy from 2001 to 2009. Along the way, he earned a PhD from Tufts University, worked at DC think tanks, and taught at the National Defense University and George Washington University. He was vice president for academic affairs at the Marine Corps University prior to his confirmation as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy, Plans, and Capabilities in August 2018. I knew James before his arrival at the DoD and always found him to be smart, thorough, and professional. He was a real team player with a serious approach and demeanor, which made it good to have him running the policy shop. While Russia and China are developing asymmetric capabilities, such as hypersonic missiles and space weapons designed to offset our strengths, America's great advantage is its global network of allies and partners. We have dozens of them. Russia and China have only a few, and those are of questionable quality. To optimize this advantage, however, the DoD needs to speak with one voice. Too often, the regional priorities of the combatant commands and the parochial interests of the armed services drove our international engagements. For example, it was not unusual for various DoD leaders to propose to a foreign military that they make different weapons systems an acquisition priority over others. A Navy secretary would ask them to buy a new ship or missile. An Army chief would urge a new ground vehicle. An Air Force leader might propose a new plane. And the geographic commander might push for something totally different, all within a matter of several weeks. Nobody was doing this purposefully to undermine the department, but it would confuse and frustrate our allies and result in unnecessary delays that sometimes played into a country's own bureaucratic tendencies. With limited resources and seeking clear direction from the United States, these types of interactions tended to reduce a partner's warfighting effectiveness and interoperability with us. The GDAP would fix this. It would enable us to prioritize and align our security cooperation activities to build partner capacity, better articulate the DoD's needs for their priority warfighting roles, and help them shape their militaries into more capable forces. The four pillars of this program were key leader engagements, international professional military education, the state partnership program run by and through the National Guard, and foreign military sales. All were successful programs, and we had plans to take each to a new level, such as expanding the highly successful International Military Education and Training Program, where allied and partner service members typically come to the United States for training or schooling by growing it 50% over the next 5 years. Strategies like this that threaten the status quo tend to generate resistance and anxiety. Some people simply don't like change. Others see their programs under threat, scrutiny, or simply losing out. The entrenched bureaucracies, military and civilian alike, tend to push back. As such, it took us months just to get the geographic commands to prioritize the 5 to 8 countries each would put in its top tier. The State Department could never come around to doing this, telling us instead that all countries are important. This was frustrating. After all, the DoD is supposed to take its foreign policy lead from the State Department. James Anderson provided that leadership notwithstanding, and after going around and around for weeks trying to resolve the command's issues with little success, he delivered the GDAP document to me. I was never one to seek 100% consensus, just 100% opportunity for everyone to share their views. We heard them out. Now it was time to move forward and do what was best for the greater good. I signed the GDAP in October 2020 and delivered a major speech on it that same month. A couple of senior leaders from President Biden's Pentagon would later compliment me privately on the GDAP, so I was encouraged that it too might endure the transition and the resistance of a few combatant commanders. A few final thoughts on civilian-military relations. Based on my experiences over many years, both at the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill, I believe Congress has a critical role to play in empowering the civilian leadership at the Pentagon and helping restore the balance of power there. First, the Senate needs to do a much better job in quickly vetting and confirming DoD nominees. It's great that the Secretary of Defense typically gets confirmed in the first days of an administration, but it then takes months, if not an entire year, to get the whole team of political appointees confirmed and in place. Moreover, failing to replace civilians quickly over time once the first wave moves on is also detrimental to civilian-military relations and civilian control. With civilians not in key positions at the Pentagon, the uniformed professionals on the Joint Staff and in the combatant commands will fill the vacuum, bolstered by their large staffs, the force of their processes, and an unbroken leadership continuity that is rarely confounded with the challenge of open positions. Second, combatant commanders should testify before Congress or meet with members and Hill staff only with their OSD counterparts alongside them in most cases. This would reaffirm civilian primacy and control of the military and give the necessary perspective of civilian leadership at the Pentagon to their congressional overseers. Another important way in which Congress can affirm constructive civilian-military relations is to give deference to reform initiatives put forward by civilian leadership and not be swayed by uniformed leaders from the services or combatant commands making end-arounds to protect their turf or advance their agendas. The quickest way to undermine civilian leadership is by empowering this type of bad behavior, which not only harms civilian control of the military, but also dampens any real enthusiasm to take on serious reforms at the DoD. At the end of the day, it is the Secretary of Defense who sees the entire landscape, region by region, domain by domain, function by function, present and future, and who is the most capable and responsible person for making the trade-offs and adjustments necessary to ensure our nation's security. Next, the House and Senate Armed Services Committees should support installing civilians at most of the defense agencies. When I was Secretary of Defense, I began moving in this direction by appointing the first civilian head of the Defense Security Cooperation Agency in years, replacing the job previously held by a 3-star officer. Civilians should lead the Defense Logistics Agency, Defense Contract Management Agency, and Defense Health Agency, much as they do at the Defense Contract Audit Agency and Defense Commissary Agency. In short, unless there is some compelling reason otherwise, any organization that begins with the word defense should be led by a civilian, preferably one with long-time, relevant private sector experience in that field or industry. An added benefit of this move is the opportunity to reduce the total number of general officers in the services, another endeavor I pursued. Finally, Congress should jumpstart a multi-year process to assess the cumulative effect of the various congressional requirements and enacted laws over the preceding decades beginning with the 1986 Goldwater-Nichols Act reforms, and determine which provisions watered down the roles, responsibilities, duties, and authorities of civilian leaders and distorted the balance of power between the services and the combatant commands. In the days following my departure from the Pentagon in November 2020, I privately raised this idea with the chairmen of both the House Armed Services Committee and the Senate Armed Services Committee. I remain committed to work with them to get this important initiative off the ground and stand ready as a private citizen if Congress wants to take me up on this proposal. Chapter 5. Tehran escalates. We sat in absolute silence watching the screen as the most significant military strike of the Trump administration unfolded before us thousands of miles away. One that threatened the prospect of violent retaliation, but one we felt we had no choice but to conduct. It was a bold action that would change the landscape of the Middle East and constituted a major test of Donald Trump as commander-in-chief. On September 14, 2019, just under 2 months after I was confirmed as Secretary of Defense, Iran launched drone attacks at a major Saudi petroleum refinery at Abqaiq. It was a complex strike that targeted two sites and demonstrated Iran's capabilities. Abqaiq is one of the most important oil production facilities in the world, so a successful attempt to knock it out would affect not only the Saudi economy, but global oil prices as well. While the Houthis took credit for the attack, the launch point for the drones wasn't Yemen. The attack shocked the Saudi leadership. They saw it as unprecedented and feared these strikes marked the beginning of a broader campaign by Iran against them. I quickly met with General McKenzie, the CENTCOM commander, and my leadership to discuss how to strengthen Saudi defenses and reassure them of our support. The biggest asset the Saudis needed were air defenses. We already had multiple Patriot batteries deployed to Saudi Arabia, but McKenzie and the Saudis wanted more. The problem was there was only so much in the army inventory, and I couldn't afford to commit most of them to one theater. The Saudis had a sufficient number of Patriot batteries, but too many were inoperable due to poor maintenance, as with other Saudi systems, a sticking point for me during my tenure. Most of the remainder focused south toward Yemen. Now Saudi Arabia had to worry about the Iranian threat to their east and northeast as well. This was particularly troubling given that Iran possesses the largest and most diverse inventory of ballistic and cruise missiles in the Middle East. These systems are accurate, with most able to reach Iran's immediate neighbors and some capable of striking southeastern Europe. They would be a top challenge for the United States and its partners if war came. While I committed some additional U.S. air defense assets, I immediately asked McKenzie and John Rood, the Undersecretary for Policy, to reach out to our NATO allies. Many of them had Patriots or other compatible systems that could help us fill the air defense gaps. However, except for one country, Greece, none stepped up to help the Saudis, even after months of asking. The Saudis also requested that we initiate our operations plan and significantly increase an array of resources for their nation's defense, broadening our commitments in a way that would result in a significant increase of troops to the theater. They would push on these matters for months and months, even during my meeting in Riyadh with the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, and in their later correspondence to the White House. The situation didn't warrant such a move yet, and I was confident the president wouldn't support it. After all, he had been spending years pressing to get out of the Middle East, not commit more forces there. We also had to be careful about sending the wrong signals to Tehran and the unintended consequences if we erred. Nobody wanted war, but what might look like defensive U.S. support to the Saudis from our perspective could appear to be the first phase of an offensive campaign against Iran, from their view. Such a misreading of the situation might force them to take preemptive action. On the other hand, not doing something might well embolden even more Iranian aggression. Finding deterrence, the sweet spot between inaction and provocation, was always a challenge. Rather than implementing the full plan, we decided to deploy those forces that were needed to open the theater. These are logistical, transportation, and other non-combat units that take a long time to deploy and set up, but are critical to receiving, processing, and supporting combat units flowing into a theater of war. Getting them in place now would help reassure the Saudis and save us a great deal of time should things go bad later. We also could do so without spooking Tehran too much. On Friday, September 20th, 2019, General Dunford and I appeared before the media in the Pentagon briefing room to announce that air and missile defense units and other assets would soon be flowing to the region to help defend the Saudis, reassure our partners, and deter further Iranian aggression. Behind the scenes, we continued working with U.S. Central Command on refining military options to present the president should the situation escalate. This process would continue through the fall. Meanwhile, the State Department was working hard to get our European allies on board, prodding Britain, France, and Germany to publicly place blame for the attack on Iran and urging Tehran to halt the provocations. The timing was particularly tricky given the upcoming meeting of the UN General Assembly in New York and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani's attendance, but the three European leaders put out a helpful statement on September 23rd. On October 3rd, the National Security Team met with the President in the Situation Room. General Mark Milley was on board by now. He became Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on September 30th, after General Dunford's well-earned retirement. The President sat at the front of the small room. Behind Trump's black leather chair, on the opposite end of the room from the large video screens, hung a presidential seal the size of a large serving plate. I, then Milley, sat to his immediate left. Across the narrow conference table and the various wires and phones strewn across it, the Vice President, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, and others faced us. More staff sat along the walls behind their principals. As much as we tried to keep these meetings small for the sake of operational security, the more others managed to find a way in. Everyone arrived before the President, which presented a good opportunity for some final small talk. We managed to clear some space at Trump's end of the table so that we had room to lay down graphics and other material in front of him. The president usually arrived on time, often dressed in his standard blue suit, white shirt, and red tie. He entered in a very business-like manner, scanned the room, and greeted everyone as he proceeded to sit. The meeting began with a short discussion about the tense situation on the Turkey-Syria border, and how state and defense were working to keep both sides apart, propose solutions to tamp down Ankara's fever, and maintain stability in the area. I had spoken privately to my defense counterpart in Turkey about these things a few times over the preceding weeks, but it was clear Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was determined to carve out a safe zone in northern Syria, a long-standing ambition of our NATO ally. Pompeo and I presented our updates in a very brief, matter-of-fact way. General Milley added some details about the force levels on the ground and the disposition of American personnel in Syria. Trump responded by repeating his long-standing desire to withdraw U.S. forces from the country once and for all following the physical defeat of the ISIS caliphate in Syria several months earlier. Unbeknownst to us at the time, the Turkish military would cross the Syrian border to the east the following week and accomplish its goal. General Milley, like Dunford before him, and I opposed this move, as well as the president's desire to hastily withdraw all U.S. forces from Syria, and counseled Trump regarding both issues prior to a call he had with Erdogan a few days before the Turkish incursion. However, the best we got from the president was agreement that the U.S. military would not provide any support to the Turks. Upon Milley's recommendation, we decided to immediately withdraw from the border area a few dozen soldiers who would have otherwise been trapped in the combat zone between the opposing forces. After the Turkish assault, I publicly criticized Erdogan's actions and his country's behavior as an ally, also noting that Erdogan seemed resolved to conduct the invasion when he spoke with Trump. Later, with help from key members of Congress, we would be surprisingly successful in persuading the president to reverse himself and permit the retention of sufficient U.S. forces in eastern Syria to continue our support to the Syrian Democratic Forces, ensuring the enduring defeat of ISIS, helping to protect Iraq, and keeping a close eye on the Iranians. Back in the Situation Room on October 3rd, we then pivoted to Iran, the purpose of the meeting. I told Trump that the chairman and I want to walk you through an updated set of options that target multiple Iranian assets, each with a varying degree of impact, estimated casualties, level of difficulty and risk, and anticipated response. He looked at me and nodded. We used a heat chart that was developed by Dunford and modified by Milley to brief Trump. It was challenging to keep the president focused. I had been in enough meetings now to experience it multiple times. A discussion would stop stone cold and pivot as a new thought raced through his head. He saw something on TV, or somebody made a remark that threw him off track. Somehow we often ended up on the same topics, like his greatest hits of the decade. NATO spending, Merkel, Germany, and Nord Stream 2, corruption in Afghanistan, U.S. troops in Korea, and closing our embassies in Africa, for example. My first full exposure to this behavior was at a principals' meeting in Bedminster, New Jersey, in August 2019 that was supposed to focus on the Afghan peace agreement. The conversations were like a pinball machine. You knew where the silver ball would begin and end its journey, but the path in between was chaotic, bumpy, and unpredictable. And to stretch the metaphor a little further, depending on who got bumped during that journey, you would either gain or lose points with the president. That was how meetings with Trump transpired. As such, we thought something very simple and visual would not only help us explain these complex military matters, but help us control the narrative, like putting guardrails on the inside of the pinball machine right down the narrow middle. I set down the chart in front of the president on the conference table, and he quickly leaned into it. You could see his eyes darting around the large graphic, with its colored boxes and lines. To fill the space and avoid unrelated questions, I quickly explained to Trump that the easier options are on the left side of the chart, with options of increasing difficulty and consequence as you move to the right, with the far right option being the most difficult, dangerous, and destructive. We literally used a color bar that ran across the graphic and morphed from yellow to red, getting hotter as you looked left to right, to visually identify the escalating options. At the top of the page, in a larger font, we listed key objectives the president said repeatedly. I read them off for all to hear, since we had handed out only a few of the graphics. It began with, "No war with Iran," and "No nuclear weapon for Iran." We wanted to remind the president of what he said, let him know that we were listening, and ensure others in the room, especially the war hawks like National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, and, to a lesser extent, Secretary of State Pompeo and Vice President Pence, were all reminded of the president's views. Sometimes other cabinet members, like Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, would be present and offer their full-throated support for tough action. Go figure. We wanted to baseline everyone attending to these key principles, the ones Trump personally approved, in case the discussion became muddy, as it often did. In my view, if we had these wrong, then this was the time to change them. Nobody ever challenged this formula. At the bottom of the page, beneath each option, we listed the estimated battle damage assessment for each target set. I made clear that these include estimated casualties, both civilian and military. I had added this after our experience in June, when the president called off the strike in response to Iran shooting down the U.S. drone. In short, we wanted to be very clear about the key details of these options, from the common strategic aims to the unique tactical considerations, so that there were no misunderstandings. With that, I turned the floor over to General Milley, who began walking the president through each of the options in detail. He would also answer questions such as, "How many missiles will that take?" Or, "How do you know there will be that many casualties?" At times, CIA Director Gina Haspel or someone from her team would speak up and respond to the president. As he had in June, Trump leaned toward the high end of strikes, those that caused the most damage. He wanted to take out Iran's nuclear infrastructure, as he would say. We would acknowledge this, walk him around a small map pointing out key sites, and then describe in basic terms how we would go about doing that. Trump hunched over the map, his eyes narrowed, looking closely. He would nod and say, "Good, good." He would invariably follow up with something like, "Let's do it. Let's go." I often had to point back to the top of the chart and say, "Mr. President, you said no war with Iran. If we do this, there is a good chance that we'll be at war with Iran." I'd continue with the seriousness the matter demanded. "And if that's the likely outcome, then we need to prepare for it before we begin." Millie and I would then pivot and speak to everything from the significant buildup of combat power to the extended timelines and other considerations. We would finish with our assessment of the costs, estimated killed, and the likelihood of war. The president would look attentively, pause, lean back in his chair, fold his arms across his chest, and take it in. He would look around the table to gauge others' reactions as well. These things clearly grabbed his attention, like a major league hitter getting a fastball thrown right in front of his chin. The consequences were significant. Pompeo often didn't say much. He generally preferred the tougher responses too, and at times would challenge assessments about the Iranian reaction. That was a fair discussion to have, and we would often turn to the CIA director or the director of national intelligence to offer their views. How would Iran respond? This question always hung heavily in the air. It was an unknown for sure. However, I contended we should assume the worst and prepare for that likelihood. Invariably, I would say, Mr. President, since we don't know for sure, then we should prepare for the worst. I don't recommend this, the hard-hitting option, but if that is your decision, we will need time to set the theater, flow in additional forces, and be prepared for all-out conflict. There was too much at stake to simply assume a country like Iran would either roll over or respond lightly to a major U.S. attack. However, putting more U.S. troops in the Middle East, especially on the scale we would need, was just the opposite of what Trump wanted to do. He was consistent on that matter. When Millie and I talked him through what such a deployment would look like, he would back off. Robert O'Brien was new to this, having just become National Security Advisor, NSA, 2 weeks earlier on September 18th. He was good at praising the DoD for its great work in pulling this all together. He gave his assessment and then chirped in his support to hit them hard, which over time became his tedious signature phrase. It made him sound tough and appealed to Trump, but I thought this was reckless, and not necessarily the role of the NSA. Rather, his job was to coordinate policy across the departments and ensure all relevant sides were represented, not become an advocate who ran his own agenda, proposed his own plans, or played up to the president. It didn't serve anybody well, including Trump, and only grew worse over time. I didn't know O'Brien before he became the National Security Advisor. His resume seemed light on the experiences and background typically found in NSAs, but he was a smart person with an upbeat demeanor who I thought would grow into the job. I had hosted a breakfast for him at the Pentagon his first week in office to welcome him aboard. We had a good conversation, and I shared with him the strengths and weaknesses I saw in the current National Security Council, NSC. John Bolton had done a really good job, but I told him that more coordination and consultation, which was the role of the council, and less direction and involvement in department affairs, views shared by my cabinet colleagues, was always welcome. "I agree," O'Brien said, committing to doing so, and then adding that he intended to slash the size of the NSC considerably, which would also help limit any meddling. I told O'Brien that my practice was to brief you and Pompeo in advance of any issue we have to take to the president to ensure you are informed, solicit your views, and hopefully get everyone's support. This was important to do not only because of the internal politics of the national security bureaucracy and the dynamics that could unfold with the president, but also because the Secretary of State was responsible for overall U.S. foreign policy, and the National Security Advisor was charged with its coordination across the federal government. "It is always best if the three of us are aligned on matters being taken to the president," I said. Bolton did this well. "And at a minimum," I added, "we at least have to speak to one another before any such discussion." Unfortunately, that wasn't always the case, and it was another problem that would also grow worse over time. Our first meeting went well, but things inevitably frayed as the NSC and O'Brien personally increasingly stuck their noses and fingers into the DoD and other departments. They also tended to take hardcore positions on issues that I believed were divorced from practical consequences. Maybe they felt they had to amplify Trump's views, even if they didn't know exactly what they were. Who knew? These tendencies, often dangerous ones, would become topics of discussion at many of the weekly breakfast meetings Pompeo would host at State for CIA Director Gina Haspel, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, and me. Mike Pompeo later told me he regretted recommending O'Brien for the NSA job to the president. Back in the Situation Room, General Milley and I advocated a graduated approach based on our stated policy outcomes in response to the action taken by the Iranians. I also had to calculate the likely consequences of our actions, assess how they could escalate, and think about some of the most relevant 9 considerations I outlined during my confirmation process. The point wasn't to pick an option today, but to think through the dynamics of them while we had the time. We also needed to consider broader issues ranging from the time it would take to build combat power and withdraw American citizens from the region, to consulting with Congress and getting the support of allies and partners. Regarding U.S. forces, I didn't want to put too many in any one region unnecessarily. It seemed like whenever you did that, it was doubly hard to pull them back out once the situation settled down. The commanders would fight to keep them in theater. Our partners would complain about feeling vulnerable. Some lawmakers on Capitol Hill would say we were abandoning allies, and you had to consider what your adversary's conclusion might be as well. Milley made the point, as Dunford had before him, that it's far easier to get into a war than it is to get out of one. I agreed and doubled down. The good news was that Trump didn't want war. He could be a man of many random thoughts and non sequiturs, but he was always clear and consistent about that. That said, the contradiction in his views was that he sometimes believed the United States could act with impunity, that the chance of starting a war was unlikely. The president often had others in the room and foreign leaders like Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu telling him, "Text redacted. For updates on redactions, including newly released or modified text, and other information regarding this book, please visit my website, www.marktesper.com. Netanyahu would say this to me when I met with him, so I was confident he was telling Trump the same thing. In my view, that seemed like a big bet to take, especially when there wasn't a pressing need to take it anytime soon. Text redacted. Even according to Israeli media, Ministry of Defense officials in Israel reportedly briefed their superiors sometime much later that, while Tehran's nuclear efforts were progressing, Iran was still 2 years away from assembling a nuclear weapon. General Milley and I left the meeting satisfied that we had delivered what the president was expecting and needed, and confident that we made all the right points regarding how to think about these matters. However, there was still a palpable sense that too many around the table wanted to strike Iran. My combat service paled in comparison to Milley's, but we couldn't help but note as we headed to our cars after this NSC meeting the irony that the only two persons in the room that had ever gone to war were the ones least willing to risk doing so now. Over the succeeding weeks and months, we would continue to refine our planning at the Pentagon. McKenzie would work to improve his defenses and capabilities in the region, especially in Iraq. And we all watched Iran and the Shia militia groups in Baghdad closely. I traveled to Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Afghanistan later in October to meet with my counterparts and talk to our people on the ground. In Saudi Arabia, I met with troops stationed at Prince Sultan Air Base, which was our primary reception point into the country. It was outside the range of most Iranian missiles, yet we had to defend it nonetheless. I spent time with the soldiers operating the Patriot Battery to get a good sense of how they saw their mission and the principal challenges they faced. It was a gritty existence in the flat, hot sands surrounding the base. The units were already building berms to help with security, and the soldiers had settled into their daily routines. As I spoke with the battery commander, I was impressed with her and the many young officers leading our frontline forces. I usually learned a thing or two from those on the ground who were actually making policy happen. It was hard to believe that was me 25 years earlier. I felt much older now, but even more impressed by the commitment of the soldiers who spent so much time away from home and in some degree of danger. America should be proud. In Baghdad, I met with Iraqi Defense Minister Najah Hassan Ali al-Shamari on October 23rd to discuss several issues, including the redeployment of some U.S. forces from northeast Syria and the planned reduction over time of American personnel in Iraq. Al-Shammari was a quiet man who stood a little over 6 feet tall, with thin, graying hair and a matching mustache. Like me, he graduated from his nation's military academy, spent many years in the army, and became defense minister in the summer of 2019. Al-Shammari was an intelligent and well-educated man who understood all the competing factors we were dealing with. But as a Sunni Arab in a Shiite-dominated political system marked by violence, tumult, and factionalism, there were limits to what he could say and do. He was pro-American and approached issues as I would expect a career army officer would, so I didn't let his cautious reticence overly concern me. Rather, the quiet support his ministry was providing to U.S. forces in Iraq and the personal assurances he was conveying to me were helpful. We had a little over 5,000 personnel in the country, with a plan to go down to 3,000 by the following summer, and even lower after that. The Iraqi military had improved considerably, which meant we could reduce our training program. Nevertheless, we still wanted to keep other assets around to conduct counterterrorism strikes against ISIS while keeping a close eye on Iran. A complete U.S. departure from Iraq would create a vacuum for Tehran to fill, even though they had a significant presence and influence there already. I told Al-Shammari, "We are committed to helping Iraq improve its security." I added that while we had no aspirations for a permanent U.S. presence in the country, we do expect Iraq to provide for our security. This meant an active defense of our bases and the arrest of any groups or individuals planning or conducting attacks against us. I pressed him hard on these points. My team was sure there was at least one person in the room from his side who was reporting back to Tehran. The fun and challenging part of this reality was trying to figure out who it might be as you sat opposite one another sipping strong coffee from small porcelain cups and exchanging niceties. Regardless, I wanted to make sure I was clear about our intentions and resolve. I added for all to hear that we don't want to see Iraq become a battlefield again, nor are we seeking war with Iran. But we are going to defend our people and interests from any attack, and will hold Iran responsible. I thought that was unambiguous. Throughout the rest of the month and into December, Iran and Iraq remained a focus as U.S. forces continued to flow into Saudi Arabia. In October, I ordered the deployment of 2 more fighter squadrons to the region, bringing the total to 3,000 additional troops I either extended or dispatched since the Iranian attack on the Saudi oil refinery. Meanwhile, Shia militia groups in Iraq continued their random rocket attacks against U.S. forces based in that country. We remained on guard as Tehran picked up the scope and pace of its bad behavior. At the same time, developments in Afghanistan with the stalled peace plan, followed by issues with Venezuela and Turkey, notably the latter's incursion into northern Syria, also demanded my attention. My weekly meetings with Pompeo centered on these matters, while my internal discussions with Deputy Secretary David Norquist, Undersecretary for Policy John Rood, and General Milley also focused on the upcoming budget submission, combatant command reviews, and the day-to-day functioning of the department. I needed to find a new chief of staff as well. Eric Chuning had been running hard for quite some time. He had a young family that needed more of his attention. I completely understood. Prioritizing the kids is a fundamental dilemma for dual-career parents, and it's especially challenging when you're coming into work before the sun rises and leaving after it sets. I often regretted not spending more time with my children when they were younger, so I had a lot of respect for his decision. I just needed some time to find the right person for what is one of the most important positions in the building. This would have to wait for a few weeks, however. On Friday, December 27th, a rocket attack on an Iraqi military base in Kirkuk, north of Baghdad, resulted in the death of an American contractor and injuries to 4 U.S. service members. Like the 11 previous attacks, this one also had the telltale signs of a Tehran-aligned Shia militia group, which we eventually determined to be Kataib Hezbollah, KH. Iran long supported KH, which had close ties to the Islamic Republican Guard Corps. KH was one of the most hardcore and capable militia groups in Iraq. It was the Christmas holiday break back in the United States, but as soon as reports began flowing in, Norquist, Rood, Milley, McKenzie, and I started meeting on secure phones from our homes to get the details of the attack, strengthen our defenses in Iraq, and begin reviewing military options. A red line was crossed. With an American killed, we had to respond. If not, the next attack would be bigger and could kill or injure more, an outcome we had to deter. The president was asking for my recommendation. I spoke with General Milley by secure phone early on the 28th. CENTCOM confirmed that KH was responsible for the strike, which involved more than 30 rockets. I gave him guidance regarding the range of options, 6 total, to develop, beginning with going after those directly responsible for killing Nawris Waleed Hamid, the Iraqi-American linguist who left behind a wife and 2 young sons in Sacramento, California. General McKenzie briefed the group later that day, and, after making some adjustments in consultation with Milley, I approved the plan. We did a final call early the next morning to review the operation one last time. Everything was still a go. The concept was very straightforward. The U.S. military would conduct airstrikes using F-15s and precision munitions against KH weapons depots and command centers in Iraq and eastern Syria. Not only would this send a message of resolve, it would also punish them for killing an American and set back any additional plans they were preparing. Shortly afterward, I called the president down in Florida, where he was staying over the holiday break, to brief him. An aide answered, and after a short wait, the president picked up the secure phone. Trump was always personally engaging. "Hello, Mark, how are you?" he said. I told him that I was calling to walk him through our recommended response to the attack that killed the American. "Good, good," he said. "What do you think?" I outlined the general concept, telling him that U.S. aircraft would strike multiple sites under the cover of darkness, and that we are confident that these are KH targets. I made clear that we will definitely kill some militia, and maybe even some Iranians, but was quick to add, we still recommended proceeding with this course of action. In these situations, when we were talking about actual military options, I usually found Trump to be attentive, listening closely, weighing and assessing, it seemed, which was a good thing. He was also more open-minded, and he postured less when we met or spoke one-on-one, as compared to a group setting. In the latter situations, he relished the drama and display of holding court and pitting people and sides against one another. As such, I tried to be more laconic and succinct in Oval Office or Situation Room meetings, keeping my powder dry and saving my best arguments or ideas for more private meetings. I had a better chance of winning the day in more personal settings, enlisting allies behind the scenes as compared to the melee of bad ideas pushed or supported by his White House sycophants. I wasn't always able to stick to my game plan, however. Sometimes you have to speak up, to draw a line, to push back hard, even if it means jeopardizing your own position in the long run. Regarding Iraq, I informed the president that the operation would take place before noon that day, December 29th, very early in the evening Baghdad time, once we finalized all preparations. Trump was familiar with the general situation and the key players since we had had these discussions before, so he was quick to approve our recommendation. The call wrapped up with him saying, "Good job, Mark. Thanks. Keep me informed." I spoke with Mike Pompeo a couple of times about the operation, shoring up our partners and public messaging. We agreed I would call Iraqi Prime Minister Adel Abdul Mahdi beforehand, which I did just prior to the strike, to inform him what we were doing and why. Abdul Mahdi wasn't happy and asked that we call off the operation. He viewed this as a violation of Iraqi sovereignty and an escalatory action that could throw Iraq into deep turmoil. "In our view," I said, "Iran and the militia groups are the ones escalating things, and he was doing nothing about it." I was clear about our right to self-defense and the expectation we had long expressed, including when I had met with him in October, about the Iraqi government ensuring our security. The DoD had long been concerned that U.S. military actions aimed at restoring deterrence could force the Iraqi government to expel us from the country. Such an outcome could harm our ability to ensure the enduring defeat of ISIS, prevent increased Iranian control of the government in Baghdad, and monitor/track Tehran's operations in the region. That said, we couldn't tolerate the killing of an American and the increasing belligerence of the Shia militia groups. This, too, could eventually make our position in Iraq untenable. After all, the goal of the militia groups and their Iranian sponsors was the removal of the United States from Iraq and from the broader Middle East. Prime Minister Abdul Mahdi was a Shiite and former member of the Supreme Islamic Iraqi Council, which was based in Iran and opposed the U.S. involvement in Iraq. He faced a near-impossible situation balancing all the competing factions in his country. A quiet majority of Iraqis supported the U.S. presence and the relative stability we provided, while a vocal minority aligned with Iran opposed it. Making matters more dangerous, many of the political groups in Iraq seemed to have their own militias they employed to defend their interests. It was tribal warfare on a national scale, and they didn't hesitate to use violence to get their way. I also called the chairmen and ranking members of the House and Senate Armed Services Committees prior to the attack. I don't believe any of them were in D.C. at the time, and none had secure phone capabilities. However, without breaching security, I was able to inform them about our plans for an appropriate military response to the Kirkuk attack. I assured them the DOD would brief them afterward as soon as possible. They asked good questions, offered advice, and generally appreciated the call. To their credit, no leaks ever came from these four lawmakers in the 18 months or so that we worked together. The airstrikes went off without a hitch on Sunday morning, with all five sites being hit and suffering extensive damage. Secondary explosions at some locations confirmed our assessment that they were weapons depots. The strikes killed at least 24 militiamen, including a few KH commanders, with over twice that number wounded. We weren't expecting tallies that high, but then again, they should have known it was an occupational hazard to target Americans. That same afternoon, Pompeo, Milley, and I traveled to Mar-a-Lago to brief the president. We gathered in a back room of the ornate estate. Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, who was already in Florida, and a couple of other White House staffers joined us. Mulvaney and I had worked together a little over 4 months by now, and I found him to be helpful and reasonable. He was easy to work with, well aware of the internal politics of the White House, and did his best to make the place function. Pompeo and I were in dark suits, with Milley in his dress uniform, making us all look out of place at the resort as we wound our way through a maze of dark wood, chandeliers, and marble floors. Trump met us in a waiting room, dressed comfortably in a white shirt with a blazer. He was relaxed and in good spirits. Robert O'Brien and CIA Director Gina Haspel called in for the meeting. The rest of us sat around the large rectangular table, with me at the end, closest to the president, so that I could walk him through the update. Trump slouched forward to listen, with his hands crossed on the table in front of him, as he often did, looking alternatively at me and others in the room. He always seemed to be assessing who was thinking what, as conversations ebbed and flowed. I kicked off the session with an intelligence update, our current force posture, and a quick summary of the additional troops we had moving into the theater to buttress our operations. General Milley briefed the president in detail on the strikes against the five KH sites and the battle damage assessments we had so far. Milley went through it quickly, with photos as well to enhance his report. On a couple of sites, we conducted both direct hits and offset strikes, the latter meaning we intentionally didn't target buildings where we assessed Iranian Guard Corps personnel were suspected of working. This tactic was an effort to message Tehran while avoiding Iranian casualties that could unnecessarily escalate the situation. To my surprise, this really angered Trump. He wasn't yelling, but he was both frustrated and mad. He sat there, hunched over, shaking his head with a grimace on his face, looking up at Milley and saying, "That was stupid, and why would you do that?" adding that, "It makes us look like we can't hit the target." This, of course, wasn't the case, and we were confident the Iranians knew that. The U.S. military had long proven it could hit targets with ruthless precision. This was about messaging and deterrence, and about our knowledge of facts on the ground. This action was about subtlety, something for which Trump was not known. Milley seemed to take the criticism a little hard and was certainly frustrated. We both were. Pompeo jumped in to help Trump put things into perspective. I tried to pull the brief out of a nosedive by saying, "Mr. President, when you step back, the bottom line is that the operation was very successful. We destroyed 5 KH sites and killed many of their fighters, and all U.S. planes returned safely to their base. Trump leaned back into his chair and said, "I guess so," in a resigned manner, still wearing the grimace of disapproval on his face. This was one of the mysteries of Donald Trump as commander-in-chief. Sometimes he would express concern about being drawn into a conflict, and he was always talking about getting out of the endless wars. In the same vein, he would call off strikes we had already agreed to. At other times, like now, he would complain we were not being tough enough and want the most aggressive options possible. His views on the use of force swung back and forth like a pendulum, though even a pendulum has some predictability. The president rarely gave us much at all. We quickly transitioned into a discussion of the military options available in the event Iran or the Shia militia groups, though in many ways they were one and the same, decided to escalate the situation. This conversation included many of the options we had covered in the past, from targets outside of Iranian territory to those in the waters of the Gulf and some in Iran proper. We had also discussed going after key leaders of the Shia militia groups in Iraq, as well as Iranian military personnel, namely Qasem Soleimani, the commander of Iran's Quds force. Qasem Soleimani was an Iranian military officer who first saw service in the Iran-Iraq War, where he earned a reputation as a capable commander. He eventually became commander of the Quds force, a branch of the Guard Corps responsible for special operations outside of Iran. He built strong relations with Hezbollah in Lebanon and with other terror groups throughout the Middle East and beyond. Soleimani's persona and accomplishments made him a popular figure in Iran. Many considered him the second most powerful person in the country, right behind the Ayatollah Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader. Needless to say, Soleimani had extraordinary influence over Iran's foreign policy and external activities. In 2007, the Bush administration designated the Quds Force a foreign terrorist organization. 4 years later, the Obama administration placed sanctions on Soleimani and other Quds Force officials for planning to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the United States in Washington, D.C. Trump raised the idea of going after Soleimani. It was an option first proposed long before Milley and I took up our respective positions in 2019, but that resurfaced every now and then. We all knew that the Quds commander was a key player, indeed the player, when it came to all the mischief that Iran was causing in the region. He had overseen the arming, resourcing, and training of Shia groups throughout the Middle East for years, and helped support or plan operations that resulted in deaths too many to number. The United Nations and the European Union had personally sanctioned him, and the United States designated him a terrorist in 2005. Soleimani's activities against the United States in Iraq during its insurgency resulted in more than 600 American service members killed, and many more wounded. In fact, the United States announced earlier in 2019 that 17% of all deaths of U.S. personnel in Iraq from 2003 to 2011 were orchestrated by Soleimani. There was no love lost for him at the DOD. We could all support going after him if the situation warranted, but Milley and I recommended a graduated response that first allowed the dust to settle from the day's strikes. After that, if Iran retaliated, we would go about hitting more targets of increasing importance to Tehran. Milley and I expressed concern that attacks on Iranian soil or aimed at Soleimani could provoke an all-out war, which was another reason to climb the escalation ladder one rung at a time until we found the point where Iran backed down. After all, the goal now was ensuring we deterred Tehran. Mulvaney joined in, pushing back with us against any precipitous actions, particularly against the higher-end targets we had identified, the ones that Trump was focusing on. The president grew irritated again, still smoldering over the offset strikes. He was frustrated that the text redacted had not taken care of Soleimani earlier, as they had been pressing to do for months, well before I arrived on the scene in June. He complained that text redacted was talking tough, but really wanted the United States to conduct the strike, which was a shrewd assessment. The DOD had long expressed reservations about such an action, concerned about consequences ranging from increased attacks against U.S. personnel in Iraq, to Baghdad evicting us from the country, and all the way up to war with Iran. The risks seemed high. O'Brien weighed in over the phone, picking up on Trump's inclination and doubling down, arguing that all the targets should be hit, and that we should hit them hard, now. Millie and I looked at each other and rolled our eyes. We quickly jumped back into the discussion and urged restraint. "We need to let the next few days play out," I said. "After all, we just took out 5 sites, killed at least 19 militiamen as best we knew, and wounded a few dozen others based on early reports. Fires were still burning, and we were hearing the strikes might have killed some Iranians as well. This was a pretty heavy price for them to pay," we argued. Millie added, "Mr. President, we own the shot clock here. No need to rush." The shot clock reference was a phrase used often at the Pentagon. The point was, we didn't need to act immediately. There was no timer on us. "If we're going to do something big, Mr. President, then we need time to prep the theater and deploy additional forces. We need to be ready for moves 2, 3, 4, and 5, I would often say. The meeting wrapped up with Trump directing us to keep developing the plans in the event KH retaliated. As the end of 2019 neared, the U.S. intelligence community, IC, was working overtime to figure out what the Shia militia groups and Iran would do next. Anti-American anger in Iraq had shot through the roof, so we had every reason to believe the militia groups would attack again. We started getting information that Soleimani would soon travel to the region to do operational planning in response to the U.S. strikes. General McKenzie had his forces at the highest protection posture, and we stayed in constant contact with state, CIA, and our allies. We held an update call for the DOD leadership team and General McKenzie on Monday, December 30th. CENTCOM gave us their latest battle damage assessment, which was now calculating 25 killed, up to 50 wounded, and 18 to 20 structures destroyed. We also discussed potential next steps in the event of a response from Iran or the militia groups, and different ways by which we might multilateralize our operations, with policy taking the lead on this. One matter we discussed briefly, but which would become a more pressing issue in the days following, was ordering the departure of U.S. military family members and non-essential personnel back to the United States from the Middle East for their own safety. While this made sense in the event that things escalated in Iraq, we also didn't want to provoke an attack by sending Americans home. Tehran could interpret this defensive movement to protect civilians as a first step toward a major U.S. invasion of Iran and decide to take preemptive action. It was a real dilemma, but also an issue we all eventually agreed didn't need to be decided just yet. Later that day at 3 p.m., Millie and I joined an update call with the National Security Team, with Vice President Pence presiding over the session. Though it happened only rarely, the Vice President brought a much different tone to the meetings he chaired. They were usually straightforward, focused, and predictable. Pence listened well and asked good questions, and he was always quick with a "thanks" or "great job." He was part cheerleader and part sounding board, though I could never tell how much influence he really had with Trump. He often didn't say much in meetings that the president attended, and he rarely disagreed with Trump in front of us. That said, I'll never forget when, as our special operators crossed into Syrian airspace on the mission to capture or kill the ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in October 2019, the Vice President asked everyone in the Situation Room to pause for a minute to pray. Pence was an evangelical Christian who would call for such moments on the eve of an important meeting or event. The President had not yet arrived, but as the large, silent screens flashed various black-and-white images from the Predator unmanned aerial vehicle feeds, the Vice President asked everyone to please take a minute and join me in a short prayer for our troops. We all bowed our heads, clasped our hands in front of us, and listened as he asked God to watch over our special operators and protect them. It was a memorable moment and said a great deal about Pence as a man of deep conviction and the care he had for our military personnel. I appreciated his thoughtfulness and respected his faith. We briefed everyone on the latest intelligence and our military options. Meanwhile, the lawyers were working through the legal basis for these plans, Pompeo shared the details of his conversations with regional leaders, all of whom were supportive of the U.S. action the day before, and states' efforts to get a positive statement out of Britain, France, and Germany. I also raised the issue regarding an ordered departure of civilians if tensions escalated. On Tuesday, December 31st, following a funeral held for the KH militants killed by the U.S. airstrikes, several hundred protesters swarmed our embassy in Baghdad. Chanting "Death to America" and other threatening slogans, they breached the compound, damaged guard posts, vandalized rooms, and lit fires. It was unclear whether they were trying to seize the embassy, but armed U.S. Marines stood guard, keeping a careful eye on the protesters from their fortified rooftop perches. The first reports of the embassy protest I saw came in shortly after 5 a.m. D.C. time on Tuesday, which was early afternoon in Baghdad. Pompeo called me not long after that to discuss security at the compound. Baghdad was our largest diplomatic mission in the world, with thousands of staff assigned. It was also well protected. We were doubly fortunate that many embassy personnel were not at work due to the holiday break. However, we still wanted to make sure the embassy was safe. Not surprisingly, many of the protesters were members of the Shia militia groups from Iraq's Popular Mobilization Front, PMF. Under Iraqi law, the PMF was an independent military force numbering in the tens of thousands that answered directly to the Prime Minister. In reality, the militia groups were receiving their instructions and support from Tehran. The videos of mostly military-age men on the scene gave credence to our internal reports. One of the attackers wrote on the compound wall, "Soleimani is my commander." This not only spoke volumes about the allegiance of the militias, but caused heightened concern that they could be armed and prepare to stage a large assault. The fact that the leaders of three of the groups, including KH head and deputy chairman of the Popular Mobilization Committee, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, joined the crowds, added to our consternation. I remained in constant contact with Pompeo. We weren't going to evacuate the embassy. We needed to show resolve and determination. We also weren't going to allow its seizure. We had to protect our people and our property. My memories of Libya in 2012 and Iran in 1979 reminded me of how important it was to defend them. Trump was very worried about Embassy Baghdad becoming a repeat of Benghazi, which had become a Republican touchstone against President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton after militants seized and burned a U.S. compound there in Libya and killed our ambassador. We were all concerned about this. Pompeo and I agreed to put more troops in the Baghdad embassy and to conduct a show of force. The militias needed to understand we weren't backing down. I spoke to Milley soon afterward and directed CENTCOM to start moving. We quickly deployed approximately 100 Marines from Kuwait to reinforce our presence at the compound in Baghdad. This would give us a lot of defensive capability. The MV-22 Ospreys, the special-purpose Marine Air Ground Task Force used to get into Baghdad, were tilt-rotor aircraft that could fly like an airplane, with the additional speed and range that a fixed-wing aircraft provides, but take off and land like a helicopter. This gave us the ability to reinforce the embassy quickly and directly. It was an impressive feat of military speed and capability. We consciously did all of this in a public way so that the Iranians and Iraqi militia groups were aware. Our social media feeds showed video footage of the Marine deployment and landings at the embassy, with heavily armed troops offloading the aircraft and moving into nearby buildings. To further bolster our defenses and effect the show of force, we put Apache attack helicopters in the skies above the embassy nearly nonstop, with armed drones flying much higher above them. Twitter posts showed footage of the armed Apaches cruising through the dark sky and dropping sun-bright flares over the U.S. diplomatic sector. The aerial display was intimidating, further warning our enemies to keep a distance. Meanwhile, I remained in contact with the president throughout the day, updating him on the force protection measures we were taking and the other actions I was considering. He was very concerned about the safety of the embassy, and he was having similar conversations with Pompeo. He feared the militias would seize the embassy. He wanted to make sure the helicopters are obvious to the Iraqis on the ground. He kept repeating this. I did my best to reassure him that the embassy was secure, This wasn't Benghazi. In Washington, D.C., we continued to press our Iraqi counterparts privately and publicly to ensure the security of U.S. personnel in Iraq, and those at the embassy in particular. Trump and Pompeo both called Iraqi Prime Minister Abdul Mahdi, who put out a statement urging the protesters to leave. Trump issued a warning to Tehran via Twitter on Tuesday that Iran will be held fully responsible for lives lost or damage incurred at any of our facilities, adding, they will pay a very big price. This is not a warning, it is a threat.